We ended up with that Israel and Judah and Edom coming against Moab, and hey, get me a minstrel. And okay, God says, make a lot of ditches, and then there was water plenty, and then Moab, which was puts them in the bonus round. Moab says, "Oh my goodness, blood! They almost be killing each other." So they run down to get the spoil, and uh-oh, this camp is very much alive, and they handed a weapon on them. And I think they. And I'll be frank with you, I think it's a mistake that they didn't press through to the victory. The whole expedition was for naught. I don't know that they ever started paying, the sheep again or whatever. And then this king of Moab comes to think that he was delivered from the battle because he offered his son. And we talked about the subjectivity of omenology. Now, there's not a real word. If you look up omenology, I don't think you'll find it. But you can, well, you may or may not, I don't even know. But the problem is we can interpret signs however we want to. It's pretty subjective. And it's kind of frustrating to me because sometimes I see things that, and it's very clear to me anyway, but it's not so clear to everybody else. I say everybody else, those who don't know God and who hate him. Okay, so that brings us to chapter four, new stuff now. Now they cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, "Thy servant, my husband, is dead, and thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord, and the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be bondmen." This was done. You can't pay your debts well. Your kids can work for me, and they'll come back in the year of Jubilee or whatever mechanism is in place, or they'll work for me until said debt is paid. And that's how it works out. So she's only got two sons. She doesn't have a husband anymore. Now she's going to be all, any chance of her making ends meet is gone from her. And Elisha said unto her, "What shall I do for thee? Tell me, what hast thou in the house?" He answers his own question. What am I going to do for you? Well, what do you got? And she said, "Thine handmaid hath not anything in house save a pot of oil." Now, a pot of oil would be a lot of oil. It's olive oil. Is it expensive in that day as it is now? Probably, for the good stuff. And a pot would be quite a bit, except that doesn't say pot. You got an alternative word for pot there? Anybody in, oh, you guys all using King James, huh? It's a jar, but it's not even a jar. It's a flask. It's the only place in the New Testament it's used. What would you do with a flask of oil? Anoint people. He was of the school of the prophets. He was a prophet. I think it's in the Mishnah, and I think Josephus tells us that this prophet is Obadiah. Not the Obadiah who wrote the book, the Obadiah who went with Ahab to find grass for the donkeys and the horses that we may at least keep them alive and we don't lose them all. You remember that Obadiah? Well, if he's working for the king, how come he's not wealthy? Government jobs in most countries still pay well. How come he has a debt? Well, I suspect, and this is, I'm really out on a limb here, don't saw it off behind me. Ahab's not one to read the law and care about what it says. Do you remember? It's in Ezekiel, 13 years. Babylon worked for God, that's what it says, in invading Tyre, and they didn't get any pay for it. Do you remember that? Well, if you were listening to my Sunday night episodes, the last few, you would have heard that. But God said, now God said, and God can't break his own word, God said the workman is worthy of his hire. So he hired these guys for 13 years. They showed up, they're young, rugged. He said when they left, their heads were bald, their shoulders were peeled, and calloused is the idea from carrying heavy loads, et cetera, et cetera. They worked for me, but they didn't get paid. God says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give you Egypt. You're going to go down to Egypt, get all the booty there. Now you're paid, okay? Why? Because God said the workman is worthy of his hire. If Obadiah is poor and in debt, what does that tell you? It tells you that Ahab was, one, a rascal, a godless heathen. We know that. That's nothing. We know that. But he didn't pay his people well. I think if you're a Christian businessman, you should pay well so that your employees don't curse you before God. Oh, yeah, he's a Christian. Oh, my goodness, he's got the first nickel he's ever earned. Every time he grabs hold of that buffalo starts crying. Oh, it's just a mess. This guy is so tight-fisted. Ahab's that way. He's got an ivory palace. He's got ivory and gold, and he's got boku dollars. He's a king. He's wealthy. He could share the wealth a little bit. I don't think so. Anyway, now, scripturally, this is an Obadiah. But I again, in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is Old Testament commentary on the Old Testament, written by rabbis. And Josephus says it's Obadiah. Josephus is a pretty good historian, generally regarded as getting his facts straight. So I think it's Obadiah. Okay, what do you got? I got this little flask of oil. I think it's kind of a keepsake, don't you think? He said, go borrow the vessels abroad of all thy neighbors, even empty vessels, borrow not a few. Do you remember who his professor in the school of the prophets was? Well, it was Elijah. Is there a similar situation like this? Remember he goes to the widow of Zarephath. Hey, make me a little cake, will you? A little thing of bread. You know, she's going to fetch him some water. And look, I ain't got anything. I got a handful of grain. I got this little oil. I'm going to bake one cake, me and my son. That's it. That's all we got. Then we're dead. He goes, yeah, you go ahead and do that. Me first. Now, not because he's a me-first kind of guy. There was definitely a test of faith here. I think says, what do I got to lose? And she makes him a cake and a little thing of bread, a morsel of bread is what it turns out to be. And that cruse never emptied, and that thing of meal, that jar of meal never emptied until the famine was over. So Elisha, he's got a case study, and he says, yeah, go borrow all the vessels. Get, not a few means, get as much as you can. When thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons, and shall pour out into all those vessels, and thou shalt set aside that which is full. Now you get a little flask. Think of it like a flask, like a whiskey flask, something you put in your pocket that's hidden away. Not that anyone would have that, but you know what it is, right? It's kind of got a little curve in it, so it's even shaped, so it's more concealed, looks like a wallet or something like that. For a real hardcore alcoholic who can't wait till he gets off work and he's got a nip. But we're just talking about a little. Now think about a gallon bucket. You pour that in there and pour that in there and it's getting filled up and you're thinking, okay, the physics here don't quite work. Well, you fill that up and you fill the next bucket up and the next jar and the next pot and the next. Listen, there'd be plenty empty. It's a famine, right? There'd be plenty of empty. Everyone would have empty jars. Not many of them were filled. How much did she actually fill up? How many gallons? You know, it's incredible to think. So she went from him and shut the door upon her and her sons and brought the vessels to her. Who brought the vessels to her, and she poured out. And it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said unto her son, bring me yet a vessel. And he said unto her, there is not a vessel more. And the oil stayed. Can't have an overflow. That would be a waste. It wasn't dependent upon God's lack. I mean, the lack was, okay, that's all the vessels I could get. You know, it wasn't like God saying, like, yeah, I was going to fill up just 2 gallons, but no, as many as she could borrow. They filled them all up. So is that a good thing? It's a great thing. And she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil, pay thy debt, and live thou and thy children of the rest. Now, I could talk here about debt. I won't. I think we all know. We've been financially, fiscally responsible church, and the people who make up the attenders of this church have been, we haven't run into like mega need and stuff like that, which is generally a symptom of sin, people not using their blessings correctly. Sometimes God takes us through a season. I remember me and Sue, we were poor as church mice one time. When I first got out of the service, I wasn't getting paid handsomely for being in the United States Marine Corps in Southern California. Dollars didn't go very far, but we made ends meet, barely. And then I got out of the Marine Corps right in the middle of a recession. It was beginning of 1981, Ronald Reagan had just taken office. And I'm not trying to be political, but he was handed a pretty bad economy. And he turned it around at some point, but not at the beginning. And I went right into headlong into unemployment was out of sight, and it was really bad. And he inherited that. And I will say this from Jimmy Carter, but I don't even want to blame him. OPEC quadrupled its prices during the Carter administration. Gas, we had the gas lines. It was really a horrific time. Gas went from 70 cents to like $1.50, and we were like, you know, $1.50 now. Well, it's different buying power with your dollar now and stuff like this, but it was, those days, that was mega expensive, and we'd wait in line for hours to get it. And just everything went up, and unemployment, right? We had double-digit unemployment and double-digit inflation. It was a tough time, and we were really struggling, and we were figuring some things out, like, is God a God of his word? I mean, we made it through. It wasn't like we didn't dry up and blow away. It was some tough times, but we always trusted in the Lord, and we still gave, and I think, you know, God will in time bless. It's not because, oh, the economy's bad. Adam, I'd like to help you out. What can I do? Not like that at all. This is a tough time. This is a dearth. Okay, nobody's eating. There's no famine. And all of a sudden, she comes up with all this oil. She sells it. She pays her debt. Sometimes a man will die and leave his wife a debt. That's generally not a good planning. And it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman. She was 9.5 feet tall. She's a little bigger than Goliath. She was real thick and broad at the shoulders. No, she was great in that she was very, very wealthy. Okay? And she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as often as he passed by, so he's going to Jericho, to Bethel, to here and there, to the schools of the prophets. That was his course, and so he's coming and going, right? And as often as he passed by, he turned in thither to eat bread, and she said unto her husband, behold now, I perceive that this is an holy man of God, which passeth by us continually. She's a spiritual woman. She's perceiving some things. Is she a believer? I think so, and it is with as little scriptures we can make out. Let us make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall. Let us set for him there a bed and a table and a stool and a candlestick, and it shall be when he cometh to us that he shall turn in thither. It's not exactly good. I don't know how important this is, but let's make a chamber of walls. Not on the wall, it's on the roof, but let's, you know, it's like, you know, which is usually a patio, flat roof. Let's build up a little room from it. We're making an addition to the house. Okay, so she's a woman of means. An addition to your house still costs a lot. It did in those days. I have an idea she wasn't a builder. We're going to find out later. Her husband's old. I don't know if he's a builder, but they probably hired it out. And he only has a, it sounds like a monk's cell, doesn't it? A bed, a table, a stool, a candlestick. He's fine. He's got everything he needs because he's a single guy and he doesn't have to have, you know, dust ruffles and, you know, blinds and what's the curtains and all that, drapes and all that stuff. He just needs a pretty Spartan existence, you know. Guys don't even know what they need and how much they need until they get married. But anyway, he's okay there, right? Just, and when he comes by, he can stay right in his own little spot. That's a wonderful thing. She's, I think she's a, not only is she a great woman, I think she's morally composed of good stuff. She goes out of her way to make him comfortable. So it's on a roof. No doubt there's already a set of steps going up to the roof. So he can come in here and, he late at night when he comes, he doesn't even have to borrow us, right? Bother us at all. It's a very generous thing. And it fell one day that he came thither, he turned into the chamber and lay there. And he said to Gehazi, now we're going to know his servant's name. The more and more we go on with Gehazi, we're not going to like him very much, I'm afraid. Some say this is the widow of Zarephath's son, whom Elijah raised from the dead. We don't know that. And again, I think I point to, I can't remember if it's Mishnah, I can't remember if it's Josephus. It's written somewhere, and I came across it somewhere, but it's not biblical. So that's one of those things, take it or leave it, whatever you want to do with it. And I don't know that it's important anyway. I just mention it for the sake of mentioning it. So he calls to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. And when he called her, she stood before him. He said unto him, say now unto her, behold, thou hast been careful for us, full of care. Careful is the idea, right? For us with all this care. What is to be done for thee? Wouldest thou be spoken for to the king? The king, Ahaziah, owes him. You remember, he pulled his bacon out of the fire when he, you know, when he showed up and prayed and God blessed with water, he'd be dead and all his host with him, all his army with him, right? So he owes him one. You want me to speak to the king about you or to the captain of the host? And she answered, I dwell among mine own people. And he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, verily, she hath no child and her husband is old. Why would a young childbearing woman marry an old guy? It was done in those days, and because he was financially stable, because he was wealthy, and maybe the child thing wasn't the biggest thing. And by the way, you know, I don't know how much say a woman had in who she married anyway. Her dad said, "Yeah, you're marrying him a week from Tuesday," and I guess that, in you know, some circles, that's pretty much it. You get the option of running away from home or tough luck for you. But it was less about love. It was more about, you know, stability and social norms and things of this nature. She doesn't have a kid. And her old man, he's really old. And you think old because men can have children well into their late years, let's put it that way. A woman, having a baby is a young woman's game. I mean, when you're 45 or something, you're really pushing the envelope, aren't you? And I've understood women have had babies into their early 50s and stuff, but you're talking about 50-year-old legs, a lot can go wrong. It's kind of a young woman's game, and I'm saying that generally, you know, in the natural. But she doesn't have any kids. Maybe he or she could never have children. He called her, and when he had called her, she stood in the door. And he said, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. That's exactly, pretty close to exactly what God told Sarah. This time next year, hey, you're going to be having a child. And she said, nay, my Lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thy handmaid. Hey, don't joke about this. It's a sore subject with her, obviously. It's something that's near and dear to her heart. That can be a sad thing. I understand. And she's like, no, too good to be true. Don't play me. Come on. You don't. When she's saying don't lie to me, she's not talking about the idea like he's deceiving her, lying, flat out just lying. It's more of like, yeah, don't con me. Don't play that game with me. Like kind of, it's too good for her. And she, of course, that's what she wants. And the woman conceived and bare a son. At that season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the time of life. And when the child was grown, now he's, child here is early, six, seven, eight, nine, somewhere in there. That's the word for child here. He's not a baby, he's not an infant. There's a special word for, you know, when they're kind of solid out a little bit, when they're like, you know, start muscling up, getting rugged, running, playing. You can actually count on them to do some work. He's a child. So, think of like not 10, but, okay, not coming up on his year away, two away from his bar mitzvah, but he's a child, like you would think of one. But he's not a baby because he's speaking. He's out with his dad. Child was grown, it fell on the day that he went out to his father, to the reapers. So they're out reaping. His dad's out in the field working. And he said to his father, my head, my head. And he said to a lad, carry him to his mother. Because that's what guys do. It's funny. It's funny to me. The more things change, the more they stay the same. One of my boys came in and said, Dad, I got a headache. I'd say, go see your mother. It's like, it's not even my department. What are you, kid? What are you, crazy there, son? So he sends, has somebody take him to his mom. And we had taken him, brought him to his mother. He sat on her knees till noon and then died. I don't know. Brain aneurysm? Sounds like? I don't know. That's all we know. So she has this child, and now the child's dead. Now, what happens in a situation, it's almost unspeakable. It certainly tests one's faith, doesn't it? And we start having to grind over who is God anyway, and why does things like this happen? And is God worthy to be praised? Did he slip up? What's going on here? And it's the tidal wave that comes, and we're flipping around in the surf, wondering which end is up and where's our feet, and am I ever going to get a chance to catch a breath again as the monster wave moves us all about and bats us like a cat with a cricket, and we're just trying to make sense of. Think about it. I mean, expend a little emotion here in the sense of like, you know, feel her pain just a little bit. And we know the end of the story, and it's a good end. But think about that at the time. She's hugging and holding on her son. There's no 911. There's nobody's coming in with an ambulance. If somebody showed up who was a medical person, what would they do? What if they didn't have any leeches? I mean, you know, medicine here isn't like medicine like we know it. So he dies. Now she's got a dead son. Who, 7 or 8, or how attached do you get? You know mama bears, you know. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Why? One, I think she's trying to hide him a little bit from dad. He'd be buried in just a couple hours. And she's got a journey to go on. And I think specifically she doesn't want him buried. She went up, laid him on the bed of the man of God, and shut the door upon him, and went out. And she called unto her husband, said, send me, I pray thee, one of the young men and one of the asses, that I may run to the man of God and come again. Does he know that his son's dead? I don't think so. And he said, wherefore wilt thou go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath. She said, it shall be well. Now, I wonder if that is, you know, it's well, like, don't worry about it, I got this. Or is it, it is well, like, it is well with my soul. I don't know. I have the idea is what she's saying is, I got this. But it is well, it's all we know, right? It shall be well. It's not well right now, but it shall be well. Then she saddled an ass and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Slack not thy riding for me, except I bid thee. Get on it. Get right onto that carburetor. Put both feet in the carburetor and don't even let up, is what she's saying. Unless I tell you, okay? And she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. Okay, we're talking about 20 miles by donkey, okay? That's a non-trivial little ride. Today, you take a 20-mile donkey or horse ride, you'd know it, unless you live in the saddle and you're very comfortable there all the time. Yeah, 20 miles, you'd know it. It wouldn't feel so good. She went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel, and it came to pass when the man of God saw her afar off, he said to Gehazi, his servant, behold, yonder is that Shunammite. Now, by Carmel, by the way, you can see the whole Jezreel Valley, and it's quite a view. And from a ways off, he can see her. Run now, I pray thee, to meet her, and say unto her, is it well with thee? Is it well with thy husband? Is it well with thy child? She answered, it is well. And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to thrust her away. And the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is vexed within her. And the Lord hath hid it from me and hath not told me. This guy's got such an exceptional... antenna tuned to the voice of God that he's surprised when God doesn't talk to him. Now, I've heard God speak, not audibly. I don't claim to. I never have. I know people who have, credible people who I've heard, who have said, I've heard God audibly talk to me. God speaks to my heart in ways that I know it's him sometimes. And I'm always amazed when it happens. This guy, God's talking to him so often, he's amazed when it doesn't happen. God didn't even tell me. This is like a total surprise. So he's winging it. He doesn't know what to do, right? Her soul is vexed within her. Leave her alone. Then she said, did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? So he's got the lowdown now. And he said to Gehazi, gird up thy loins and take my staff in thy hand and go thy way. If thou meet any man, salute him not. If any man salute thee, answer him not again and lay my staff upon the face of the child. Now, when he's saying don't salute me, he's not saying, listen, somebody says hi to you, divert your eyes. Don't lollygag is the idea. Don't stop and visit because it's kind of incumbent upon people to visit. It's, you know, Mideast hospitality, you know. You, hey, so what's your name? Where are you going? Where are you from? What's going on? You stop and, you know, you visit. That's what you do. And he's saying, this is urgent. Don't lollygag. Don't fool around. Lay my staff on him. Lay my staff upon the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. Now, tell me a time when you read or that we went over recently where somebody said, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. Elisha said that to Elijah, the exact phrase, word for word. He said that exact thing. It's just funny that now Elisha's hearing that. And he knew that he was going to stick to Elijah like glue. So he's thinking, okay, this woman, she's not going anywhere. I will not leave thee. And he arose and followed her. I ain't going anywhere. I'm not running back there. Okay, this is a 20-mile ride. Did it happen in one day? Yeah. Round trip, 2 days, most likely. That's if they're really booking it, right? Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff upon the face of the child. I like Gehazi at this point. He's obedient. He does what he's required to do. When the lady grabs him by the feet, she's like, you know, he wants to get rid of her. Like, you know, it almost reminds me of the disciples when, you know, mothers are bringing their babies to Jesus. Master has no time for your little snot-nosed brats. Get them out of here. Jesus was very indignant of that. And this seems kind of like the same spirit. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But here he does what he's required. He lays the staff on the face of the child. But there was neither voice nor hearing when he went again to meet him and told him, saying, the child is not awakened. He's expecting resurrection. That's the purpose. Sometimes your staff can't handle something. Sometimes you got to do it yourself. Some people, you know, sometimes, I was going to Calvary Chapel. Ken couldn't really marry all the people who wanted to be married. There's not that many, you know what I mean? He's got a staff. He's got other people. My son was married at Calvary Chapel. He wasn't married by Ken. He was married by one of the youth guys at that time. Sometimes the answer is no, it's got to be you, either because that's what the person requires or that's what's required. You know, I want to be like the guy who, hey, this guy can do that or this person can do that and share the load and share the blessing, but I don't want anyone to think I'm lazy. It's really a balancing act. But this isn't a Gehazi thing. This is an Elisha thing. He's the one with the double blessing. When Elisha was come to the house, behold, the child was dead and laid upon his bed. He went in therefore and shut the door upon them twain and prayed unto the Lord. Now he had heard from Elijah, no doubt in my mind. He heard from Elijah the resurrection of the widow of Zarephath's son. It wasn't a supernatural birth. When he ran into the widow of Zarephath, she already had a son who he raised from the dead. Now, the remarkable thing about Elijah is he didn't have a case study. Nobody is raised from the dead until Elijah did it. Now, here's his protege, Elisha, and he's going to do the same thing. He went up and lay upon the child, put his mouth upon his mouth, and his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Is that just sharing the body heat? Did he die of hypothermia? You know what I mean? He had a headache, right? And it was during the harvest time. What is that? 50 degrees or something. You know, it wasn't like he's below zero and they're in an Arctic climb. I don't know if there's any medicine here. I don't think so. I think it's a supernatural act of God. Why is he doing what he's doing? I don't know. I don't know. He puts his mouth on his mouth. Is that, you know, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation? No. He's mirroring him. There's no eyes on eyes. And you can't put your eyes on somebody else. You can't touch your eyes with somebody else's eyes. The eyes don't work that way. You got a forehead, you got a nose, you got cheeks, and you got eye sockets. But he's mirroring, like, you know, nose-to-nose, kind of, you know, belly-to-belly kind of idea is what we're looking at. Then he returned and walked into the house to and fro and went up and stretched himself upon him. So he does this more than once. You pray and it doesn't happen. What do? Pray some more. I don't know. This has always been my methodology. He can't take no for an answer. This is God had promised this lady this child, and now it's not really God. I think God has taken them both to a lesson in faith. Listen, who's the giver of life? who's the sustainer of life, who's the giver of resurrection. I want you to know these things, guys. Not only the woman here, this great woman, but also Elisha has to know. That wasn't a real just a story. I'm sure he knows that it happened. But when you hear about something happening, a remarkable, incredible thing happening, and that marvelous, incredible, awesome thing happens to you, isn't that a different thing altogether? So he stretched himself upon him, and the child sneezed 7 times. What's that about? I don't know. Jump start? I don't know. I can't comment on that. I don't know the medicine about it. I don't know what it's significant of. It just happened that he sneezed 7 times, and here it is recorded. I don't know, right? And the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. So he called her, and when she was come in unto him, he said, take up thy son. She went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. What is her heart doing? It doesn't describe it because it's probably indescribable. She's doing the happy monkey dance. She's doing somersaults in her heart. I don't know if she's physically capable of that. Your son's dead. It's hopeless. No, it's not hopeless yet. There's a man of God, and we're going to... But she's hoping against hope. She doesn't know anyone this has ever happened to. Did she know about Elijah and the widow of Zarephath? Who knows that? But she knows who God is now, if she ever doubted it. And she knows that Elisha is his servant. And Elisha came again to Gilgal, and there was dearth. Dearth in the land, and the sons of the prophets were sitting before him. He said to his servant, set it on the great pot. The sons of the servants are sitting, so he's got a Bible study going, right? The sons of the prophets were sitting before him. No doubt he's teaching. He said to his servant, set it on the great pot and seethe pottage for the sons of the prophets. And one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered thereof wild gourds, his lapful, and came and shred them into the pot of pottage, for they knew them not. I have a program. you flash on something, you take a little picture of it and tells you exactly, either mushroom or fruit or vegetable or plant, it'll tell you exactly what it is. It'll tell you, oh, don't touch it, don't go near it, don't eat it. I found wild rye. We have Russian rye growing right in Maine. In Farmington, on the job site, I used to pick the rye with my hands and kind of thresh it with my and snack on it, you know, because I knew what it looked like from this little program. And so if I was ever on alone in Maine, I'd be okay. And I just, never mind. I'm just being silly now. But he doesn't know. He doesn't know. In a time of a famine, and you find a whole vine full of food, guess what? If nobody's touched it, there's probably a reason for that, right? So he fills his lap full. He comes in and he shreds them so nobody else can see what they are. There's kind of a wild cucumber that grows in that part of the earth, and it's quite toxic. And they poured out for the men to eat, and it came to pass that they were eating of the pottage that they cried out and said, oh, thou man of God, there is death in the pot, and they could not eat thereof. So not only is it toxic, but all the stuff that's in there that's good, we can't have it now. That's too bad. That's such a waste. But he said, then bring meal and cast it into the pot. And he said, pour out for the people that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. Meal, the grain, like a grain offering, think. So if you add wheat or, you know, rye, or something to poison, you're all set then. That's not what this is teaching. That's not what this is teaching. What is bread usually symbolic of? Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. You know, give us this day our daily bread. You know, there's people who have like daily bread ministry, and it's what they give you is Bible verses and a little devotional. Forget it, I want a sandwich. No, this is bread, and this is the bread you need. bread of life is very often the Word of God. So, you know, this poison that comes in, what is that? Well, it's what we were looking in Colossians. It's this philosophy of men, this vain thing that it's toxic. It will, if you believe it, if you eat it, ingest it, it's going to take you down. It has the death built right into it. The Word of God has life-giving properties built right into it. And what you need, you know, if you try to separate it out, it's awful hard when something's cooked and it's all the flavors got to know each other and stuff. It's awful hard to undo that, right? You teach good and the poison goes away. That's my big heartache. You remember I told you, and I've been really kind of trying to be transparent in this. No greater heartache, no greater joy than to see my children walk in truth. No greater heartache than to see them introduced to error and bad doctrine and bad teaching. And once I've left it, people who have like, oh, Adam, you don't have enough faith. You're not one of those name it and claim it crazy people. What does your heart do with that? Cries. I just keep putting out the bread, and I think the toxins get rid of themselves. But the bread, it's not magic in this. You pronounce it, then everyone's automatically full, and everything's going good, full steam ahead. You gotta imbibe. You gotta take it in, and then you've gotta use it in a way that, you know, James says, we can't be just hearers of the word, and we don't do what it says. It's like a man looking in a mirror, walking away and forget what he looked like. Can you think how crazy that is? That anytime you ever look in the mirror, did it surprise you? Wow, who's that? No, of course not. We know who we are. The Word of God shouldn't be that way to us either. Like, who am I? But the putting in of the grain of the meal, you can think of it like a meal offering or something like that. That, and then of course I had to take a measure of faith. Wait a second, I was getting severe cramps here just a moment ago. That, you know, I ate a spoonful of that and I'm all better. And you want me to have another bowl of it, huh? You know, it takes a little bit of faith. But that's how the Word of God is. It's mixed with faith. And there you go. So there was no harm in the pot. And there came a man from Baeth Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and full ears of corn in the husk thereof. And he said, give unto the people that they may eat. Hey, the workman's worthy of his hire, right? And here's a godly man. Was he going to take an offering down to the temple in Jerusalem? We got a man of God right here. And he's kind of doing the priest function. No, he's not doing offering because there is no temple. You can't just offer anywhere. But he's in between people and God and making sure they're on the right track. And he's interceding and praying and doing the kind of the priest function. And this guy brings him his tithe, as it were. And he's, yep, give it unto the people that they may eat. And his servitor said, what should I set before this? What should I set this before? 100 men? It's kind of the loaves and the fishes in the Old Testament. What the guy brought was a generous gift. 20 loaves of barley and full ears. But we're talking 100 of the sons of the prophets. Is this all in the same scene, by the way? They get this pottage that was bad, now it's good. Now this guy knock on the door, this guy shows up. And it's plenty for Elisha, but it's not plenty for 100 men. It's again, it's like, you know, a few fish, a few loaves, right? What should I set before, should I set this before 100 men? He said, give the people that they may eat, for thus saith the Lord, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. They're going to eat till they're satisfied, and there's going to be some extra. Because that's how God is. Have you found him to be like super cheap? just such a tightwad our God is. Not at all. So he set it before them, and they did eat, and left thereof, according to the word of the Lord. Remember about our generous God. Remember, we were talking about this Sunday morning. We'll end with this point. God gave us Jesus Christ. With him won't he freely give us all things. He's given us all things pertaining to life and godliness. We have to know that. At some point, we have to figure that out. He's going to take us through our trials, test us. And the tests of God are pass or retake. And if it's a tough test, you want to pass it the first time. And how do you pass it? It's an open book test, faith. It's an open book test. Set up a form. Go ahead and feed the guys with this. Thanks, by the way. Appreciate it. God bless you, sir. Now, give it to the people. Well, ain't enough. Oh, yeah, it is. God's in it's enough. Always enough. A little boy's lunch. Little mom. Some mom in, in the Galilee thinking like, you know, Billy Smithers' mom. Don't you go off without food. She's feeding him lunch. That's all she's doing. Good mom, right? This is the version of PB&J back in the day. Did she know she was going to feed 5,000 that day? No. But it's a little bit in our estimation. God in it, it's sufficient. All sufficient grace. We'll end there. So we did one chapter, but it's a long chapter. Now we're going to talk about Naaman, the Syrian general. Oh my goodness, this is good stuff. But I didn't want to rush through it, so I knew that we wouldn't have time for that. But that's fine, we'll pick that up next week.